The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Improvisation at the world-famous Second City Theater. This podcast is about navigating work and life without a script. Improvisation is a practice in collaborating more effectively, tapping into your full creative potential, and building ensembles who can both support and challenge us. If you like what you hear, please rate us on iTunes and share the podcast through your social media channels. Help us extend the conversation. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tight and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Catherine Sanderson. Catherine is the Manuel Family Professor of Life Sciences at Amherst College. In 2012, she was named one of the country's top 300 professors by the Princeton Review. She has published more than 25 journal articles and book chapters. Professor Sanderson speaks regularly for public and corporate audiences on topics such as the science of happiness, the power of emotional intelligence, the mind-body connection, and the psychology of good and evil. Her work has been featured in outlets such as the Washington Post, the Boston Globe, the Atlantic, and CBS Sunday Morning with Jane Pauley. She has a new book. It's called The Positive Shift, Mastering Mindset to Improve Happiness, Health, and Longevity. Catherine Sanderson, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for the invitation to talk.
In the introduction to your book, you write, quote, "Our happiness in daily life, the state of our physical health, and even how long we live are largely determined not by external events, but rather by the way we think about ourselves and the world around us." And when I read this quote, I immediately thought about Norman Vincent Peale and that whole power of positive thinking movement. I know, you're groaning. I'm giving you a chance to ungroan. How is this different than that very dubious movement of the 50s?
Okay, so you are dating yourself, I think, first of all, by sharing that reference, which I'm not sure how many podcast listeners today will recognize.
Norman Vincent
Peale. But here's what I think is different. What's different is that we know more about science. Mm-hmm. So that book was really sort of a pop cultural phenomenon, but it wasn't backed up, as you just said, you know, sort of dubious. It wasn't backed up by empirical, rigorous scientific data. And with the advances that we've had over the last, you know, really about 10 to 15 years in terms of neuroscience, in terms of genetics, we just know a whole lot more about the science behind the link between how we think and how we feel.
Yeah, I figured that was as much. So one of the initiatives that I co-lead is a program called Improvisation for Caregivers, and it's a collaboration with a group called Caring Across Generations, and one of their goals is to change the public conversation around aging in America. So I was really intrigued at how much this book lays out the science behind why that is such an important thing in our country.
I love that you do that. I had not heard about that group before, and I love that you do this. And I think you've really illustrated a fundamental point. The messages that we constantly see in our society, and I'm really talking about the United States, a lot of other Western cultures, the messages that we hear about aging are so negative that, you know, people are less attractive physically, people lose their minds, people can't drive. They're all these terribly negative images, and you actually don't see such negative beliefs about aging across the world. It seems to be almost a uniquely or predominantly American/Western culture phenomenon, and it's not surprising that if you have negative expectations about aging, there's going to be negative consequences. But that's an example of something we actually could change.
Yeah, and this is this concept of stereotype threat that I think behavioral science tells us. We fall into the stereotype and that affects our behavior, even though it might not be even true for us.
And it affects our behavior. It affects the behavior of people around us. So I remember at some point going to give a talk on this subject. I think it was in Dallas. And an older man came up to me at the end and he said, "I'm so glad I attended your talk. I have these, you know, great children who are all about, let me take care of you, Dad. Let me do this for you and let me help you and let me drive you." And he said, "And after I've heard your talk, I'm going to tell them to let me alone." that I need to be doing some of this stuff myself. And it was really the perfect example, is that people were being very kind to him. He was surrounded by love, but they were unintentionally creating messages for him that were about incompetence.
Yeah, we did. So Caring Cross Generations came in and did a program that we call Brand Stage, where we kind of, it's like a focus group, except it's improv actors. So it is through humor, gaining insights. And they wanted to figure out, are there ways we can sort of comically talk about this issue? And we brought in all these people who were sort of caregiving adjacent. They were starting to have to deal with taking care of their parents, and their kids were starting, you know, to come along as well. So the sort of sandwich generation. But one of the things that was fascinating in the debriefs was how much otherizing language gets used when we start to talk about our aging parents. And these are from their kids who love them. It just feels like it's in our bones, and it's such a like weird thing.
Right. And that's the key, is that it's all very well-meaning.
Mm-hmm.
But it has really negative consequences.
All right. You cite this New York University study that brought in college students who thought they were part of a study measuring language proficiency, but it was not a study about that.
No. And that's one of, I think, the most vivid examples, in which they brought in these, you know, young college students, and they exposed them at a subliminal level, so below the level of conscious awareness. They were doing a task that was, for some of them, priming stereotypes about aging. Some of them were doing a task that didn't prime such stereotypes. But the students had no idea that as they were unscrambling these different words, these different sentences, that was the point of it. So half the students come in, are reminded of aging by words like wrinkles and, you know, arthritis and gray hair and whatever, and half of them unscramble neutral words. The students then thought the study was over, but no, in fact, this is the really interesting part. As soon as the student walked out of the experiment room, the researcher pressed a stopwatch and just timed how quickly it took students to walk down the hallway. And what they found was that students who just unscrambled these words that cued old age walked slower.
Wow. That is wild. I mean, it's a form of anchoring, right? I mean, is that what you're doing with them?
Well, I mean, here's what's really interesting, is that it's clear that there's an effect. It's not a massive effect. It's not like for the rest of their lives, you know, these students walk slower. But it's a reminder that when people are reminded, again, even at a very subtle level, that here are the things that happen when you age, it actually changes their own physical behavior. It also, of course, changes how we interpret other people's behavior if we're reminded of particular stereotypes. So it works for our own behavior, but it also works with how we interpret other people's behavior.
So one other item on this topic, which is, you write in the book, quote, older adults actually score even higher than younger adults on crystallized intelligence. What's crystallized intelligence?
So researchers in psychology have examined different kinds of intelligence. And part of our intelligence that I think we often prioritize in daily life is the ability to, you know, process things very quickly. So many standardized tests, you know, the SAT or whatever, those are timed tests in which the goal is to complete it as quickly as possible. And we assume, you know, smarter people are faster. That's a kind of intelligence that's called fluid intelligence. But there's another kind of intelligence that's called crystallized intelligence, and this is really about the wealth of information that you have, the facts, historical events, general knowledge about the world. And the reality is, older people have been alive longer, so they have more experiences in which they can draw on. If you ask a younger person, you know, who was president in 1950, maybe they can go back and kind of recreate, you know, what they had to learn at some point, or think about a major event in U.S. history that happened in 1950 and who was president. But an older person might say, oh, yes, I remember it well. You know, that was when I was finishing high school and so got elected or whatever. And so part of it is that older people actually have had more of a chance to learn things because they've had more experience. They've been around longer.
Yeah, it was so interesting. All right, I want to shift a little bit because you talk about healthcare, a connected subject, and you have a quote in here which was a little surprising at first when I read it, which was, expensive brand name medications do work better, but here's the irony, these medications work better only because we believe they do.
Right.
Okay, so it's not better medicine, but we make it better medicine because we think it's better medicine?
I mean, here's the example that I always give when I talk about this subject. Many people have had the experience of walking around, you know, your Walgreens or CVS or, you know, whatever, drugstore. You have a sore throat or a headache or a bad cold or whatever. And there's this decision. You know, I could spring for the really expensive brand name stuff, or I could go with the cheap brand. And that's a decision point. Many people say, well, I really would rather pay less money, but I'm also worried that, you know, this medicine is less good. But here's the irony. The medicine that's cheaper is less good only because you know it is cheaper. That's it. There's nothing that's different about its drug properties. If you bring into the people into the lab and you say, you're going to experience a moderately painful electric shock, but here is some numbing cream that costs $25 a dose.
Yeah.
That'll help. And you tell other people, well, I can give you a numbing cream and it costs 10 cents a dose. Now, in both cases, people are receiving the exact same ointment. In reality, it's actually nothing that's related to numbing or making them feel better. But people who believe it costs $25 a dose report feeling less pain than people who are told it costs 10 cents a dose. There's a really simple example.
Yeah. So, all right. So labels matter in the same way I think we know framing matters, right?
Absolutely.
All that. I actually wrote in the margins, because this is kind of, I'm still early in the book. I wrote down the words post-traumatic growth. And I'm like, oh, this seems to be connected. And of course, that comes up later in the book. But I actually was introduced to this concept a couple of years ago when my wife and I helped lead a retreat at Penn for Martin Seligman and Scott Barry Kaufman. And it was during a break where Scott was like introduced this concept of post-traumatic growth. And I just think it's a fascinating idea that this basic idea that sometimes through this adversity, we can actually become even more resilient.
Yes. And the challenge of this one, of course, is it fits right in line with a sort of trite expression we have, which is that which doesn't kill us makes us stronger.
Right.
I mean, that's the trite expression. But the reality is, people who have undergone serious trauma, serious adversity, can at times, and, you know, in reality, it's not every person all the time, but can at times emerge from that experience stronger physically, stronger psychologically, happier, that people actually report experiencing some positive changes. There's really interesting research that I describe in the book that looks at the role of adversity. And what this research shows is that people who have experienced 2 to 6 adverse events. These are things like getting divorced, you know, getting fired, death of a loved one, serious injury or illness to yourself, etc. But so serious things. People who have experienced 2 to 6 of these adverse events actually report having higher levels of happiness than people who have experienced no bad events at all. So people who basically have gone through a, you know, very easy, pleasant life, no adverse events, are less happy than people who've undergone, you know, a moderate number, 2 to 6. And researchers believe that's because experiencing some adverse events gives you skills in coping, in mustering your resources, greater resilience, and so on.
All right, so I'm going to attempt not to get too meta, but I might be getting too meta here. When you first started talking about this, I think it's a good thing to point out that this is a classic one of those situations where both things can be true, that there is a trite element to the Norman Vincent Peale, W. Clement Stone, you know, idea of power positive thinking, but then there actually is science behind the idea that, you know, your mindset affects how you think, how you feel, how you behave. And indeed, with a lot of this research, we're talking about a certain category of individual, maybe someone who's not into the poverty scale, someone who's not dealing with that kind of adversity. So there's that sort of both things can be true. Talk a little bit about that dilemma of when, because you've mentioned this in a couple times in the book. I see you sort of say, hey, we're talking about a certain category of people here, but it doesn't apply to everyone who are, when the context is very different in terms of their maybe social situation or social strata.
Yeah, so here's one of the things, and I think this may be kind of what you're getting at. This research does not suggest if you have cancer and you think positively, you can cure it.
Yes. Yeah.
And I think that's really important to keep in mind, because I think the danger and the hazard of a focus on positivity, which I do think is really important, also means then if somebody is feeling sad or is feeling lonely or is taking some time to recover from a loss, a grief, a disappointment, or of course, in the most serious case, somebody who has a life-threatening terminal illness, people around them, you know, say, well, you know, if you were more positive, you know, maybe that would help or whatever. And so I think it's really important that people not get into blaming somebody who maybe is taking longer to be able to find the bright side or who is really stuck in some way because of their life circumstances. The study that I described before showing people who have had 2 to 6 negative life events have greater happiness than, you know, fewer, you know, 0 or 1, that's true. But also people who've had, you know, 7 or 8 or 9 life events, they experience lower levels of happiness. And of course, yeah, there are times in which negative life events cluster. You know, somebody gets divorced, also, you know, may experience, you know, financial hardship and so on.
Is that, and now you remind me of my earlier point, which I was thinking about the fact that you kind of need to have the stumble in order to know what the graceful move is, right? And we know this in improvisation because we talk about the need to fail a bunch on your feet in order to then sort of get to the sort of beautiful place that you want to go. And that's okay because that's the way we live. But a lot of us try to sort of, you know, protect ourselves and we don't take risks. It's the same thing when you talk about with people who, you know, get hurt in a relationship and then they just don't want to get in a relationship. It's like that comes with it. And that's what makes love so great is that, you know, you don't know it unless you've had your heart broken.
Right. That's a wonderful example. And I think the fear of failure is what leads so many people to not take a chance, whether that's not taking a chance of expressing romantic interest to somebody or making a big shift in terms of their career goals, yeah, et cetera. But what's particularly interesting to me about that research on fear of failure is that when you ask people, what are your biggest regrets? Overwhelmingly, people report they regret inaction, things they didn't do. Oh,
yes.
I wish I had fill in the blank. And we have many more regrets about inaction than we do about action.
Yeah, when we have a program that we have with the University of Chicago called the Second Science Project that looks at behavioral science through the lens of improvisation. And we were working with Richard Thaler when he was running the center there at when this first started. And as I started to look at that sort of those principles of behavioral economics, sort of this idea that the default is to do nothing. And you look at what is the number one rule in improvisation, it's to say yes and. It's to not say no.
Yeah, I love the connection. That really it is a sense of improvisation is the key to all of this, right? That,
yeah,
that you have to take chances, that you have to take risk, that you sometimes fail. I love it. I mean, I love that commingling.
Sure. Well, and there's practice, right? I mean, so recognizing all that. So another area, this is also connected, which is really neat, is you talk about the importance of social networks. And then we also talk about the danger of social networks, right? So this is really cool, I think. So you write, quote, happiness like the flu is contagious. So let's unpack that. Why is this sort of connection to other people so good for us?
Well, so there's two parts. So one, having meaningful relationships is the single best predictor of our happiness. And so that doesn't mean having, you know, what I like to call Facebook friends, you know, 1,000 people who you don't really know or care about. Having meaningful relationships is really important, and that could be with family members, you know, friends, romantic partners, you know, colleagues, whatever. That's really important in terms of our happiness. But the other aspect is that the happiness is contagious, like the flu example, is really from research showing that we are happier when we are around happy people. that having happy people in our lives brushes up and makes us happier. And of course, conversely, you know, being around people who are always negative, you know, gloomy, pessimistic, et cetera, is actually debilitating in terms of our happiness.
Yeah, I was talking to a colleague this morning about the book and the impending interview, and I said one of the things that you cite is having long, sort of meaningful conversations with people is good for you. And I love, I mean, this is one of the lucky things about working. It's like where you were. In working in academia, you're sort of forced to have those. Working at an arts theater in school, you're forced to have those. It's almost like it's feeding that. Now, now the other aspect of the social network are things like Facebook, which are, you know, majorly problematic for a number of reasons. We don't need to go into all the reasons, but let's talk about the sort of comparison idea on Facebook that is really damaging.
Well, and to me, that's the very worst aspect of it. Yeah. So I have three teenage children of my own, and what I say repeatedly to them is that when I was in high school, I am old enough that I never had to look at pictures of parties I wasn't invited to while they were happening. And my kids experience that all the time. And that's something that is just such a massive change in that now people present these lives online and the lives are great. The lives are, you know, full of impressive accomplishments and, you know, oh, my child's on honor roll and, you know, I just ran the Boston Marathon and, you know, and so on. And the challenge is that many people might feel very happy about their own lives right up until they get on Instagram or Facebook or whatever, and then all of a sudden feel, oh, you know, my life really, you know, doesn't measure up to what these people are experiencing.
And it's not even necessarily a true experience, right? Because people are representing a side of them on Facebook that they want people to see.
Of course, and that's one of the challenges, is that the images on any kind of social media are deliberate. They're chosen. And so what you're seeing is not even people's real lives. You're seeing what they've chosen to present. And we all can think about times in which we were presenting something on social media that didn't really portray the whole picture because the whole picture was sad or depressing or hard.
So speaking of that, there was this stat you had in the book that was really kind of shocking to me, and it was that the teen suicide rate in Palo Alto is four or five times the national average.
Isn't that just brutal?
Oh, my God. And then you, when you think about it, I'm like, wow, I spend a lot of time out there in Silicon Valley. We do a lot of training out there, and I'm like, oh, I think I get this. So unpack that a little bit for us.
Well, I really have a question for you. Why do you think that makes sense? Can you give me your intuition from having spent some time there? Do you have an intuition about why that makes sense?
I do, and it's connected to what we just talked about. First, you know, this is the home of the digital world. It's very status oriented. A lot of wealth. A lot of comparison. I've done a lot of work on the campus at Stanford. That is a different vibe, and it is a I mean, it is, I don't know. So, you know, we've worked at the University of Chicago. I've done some stuff at Harvard. When I get to Stanford, it feels like an intellectual beauty contest. Do you know what I mean?
I do. And let me now say, in the interest of full disclosure on this podcast.
Oh, I know.
I was an undergraduate at Stanford. And I met my husband at Stanford. And yet, I will say, and listen, it's a fabulous school.
Yes.
I'm lucky to have gone there. I would not get in today. But that being said, I worry about people growing up and thinking that's the dream. Because the reality is, it's not the dream. And I teach at, you know, a really elite school. I teach at Amherst College. You know, many students who are there, it's, you know, this is the best and the brightest, et cetera. And in 2018, we lost two students to suicide. And these are kids who are super smart. You know, many of them have never had less than an A or an A minus throughout high school. They all have strong SATs and AP classes and extracurriculars and so on. And yet they're not happy. And to me, that's ultimately the key, is that we can hold up, you know, these ideals of, you know, college admissions to Stanford and so on as, well, then my life will be perfect. But the reality is it isn't. But all of those kids growing up in Palo Alto, you know, going to, you know, the two top, you know, really top public schools in the country, are seeing Stanford as the goal. And the reality is Stanford can't be the goal for all of them, you know, statistically.
Right.
And so that means, you know, if you get into UC Berkeley or whatever, all of a sudden you failed in some way. And I think it's brutal in part because of that comparison. And as you noted, the extreme wealth is very, very difficult. There's a phenomenon I talk about in the book called the wealthy neighborhood paradox. And this is that people who live in really wealthy neighborhoods are often less happy because living in a wealthy neighborhood means there's a comparison all around you, and it's very hard to measure up.
So interesting. What also I find interesting is how many entrepreneurs who work in the social media business don't allow their children to be on social media.
It's pretty telling, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's a lot of them. I mean, you think about the major leaders that, like, Reid Hoffman's talked about this. They're like, oh, no, yeah. I mean, they know that it's dangerous.
It's bad.
My friend Neil Stevenson, who worked for IDEO, he ran the IDEO office here, says that we're going to look at the cell phone just like we would look at the hip flask. You know, like, why would you ever have that in your pocket? You know,
and that's so interesting.
I really hope that's true.
Really hope that's true.
No, me too. All right, so let's shift to some positive things. There's things you can do to make yourself happier, and one of them, and I'm big on this, is smile more.
Mm-hmm.
That's
a really simple one. It's a really easy one. And I think there's two reasons why it helps. One, people react to you more positively. If you smile at somebody, you're more likely to get a smile in return, so it sort of feeds off itself. But there's also really interesting research showing that the mere act of smiling, even if you're not happy, the sort of fake it till you make it idea, the mere act of smiling changes how you feel psychologically and seems to change even how your body responds to pain.
Wow. All right. The other thing, and my buddy Nick Epley at the University of Chicago said this to me once, which he says, if you're in a bad mood and you want to get out of that bad mood, do something nice for someone else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's a really great thing. That research shows donating to charity, volunteering in your community, you know, doing a favor, doing a random act of kindness, giving to other people, strangers or friends, helps us. It's actually extraordinarily beneficial for our own well-being.
Yeah, yeah. And another one I loved, and this is something I remember having this conversation with Heather Caruso up at the University of Chicago when I first met with her and we started talking about this idea of how do you blend improv and behavioral science. And her thing is like, what brought you to my doorstep? And I had said, well, you know, I produced at Second City for like 25, 26 years, and I still have a passion for my work, but I wanted to do something different. And so I did this sort of shift, and I started focusing in on the pedagogy and then the application of improvisation offstage. And she goes, well, you know, there's a fair amount of research that and evidence that might suggest that people are less happy when they sort of stay in the same job forever doing the same thing. But what you've seen is that people who can make a slight shift use their mastery in a different way, that they are happier. And I think this connects to the thing where you talk about this keep learning new skills, that becomes a thing that can make you happier.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting because I've been a professor for 20 years and I love teaching. It's extraordinarily rewarding. But I will say honestly, you know, intro to psychology is kind of intro to psychology, and I've been teaching that for 20 years. And one thing that's really given me sort of renewed energy has been trying to write for a more, you know, popular press audience, the new book that you and I are talking about, and speaking to broader audiences. And it's a way in which I've, you know, taken my teaching and my writing that was for one audience, you know, undergraduates and professionals in my field, and I'm trying to sort of develop skills in conveying some of the really interesting and exciting parts of psychology more broadly to the world, and that's a way in which I'm really pushing myself to develop new skills and abilities within my field.
Well, and yeah, and from what I understand about many of your colleagues, this is a tough thing because, you know, a lot of the most popular books that traffic in these concepts are popularizing them them to the extent that they aren't necessarily the actual science or evidence.
That is really true.
Yes, so.
And I'm glad that you said that, because I think it's really important to recognize that the most important part of the research that you and I have talked about is that it is science. It's not just, you know, someone's idea that they came up with and they've now written a book, or, you know, they're doing a TED Talk on. This is all stuff that scientific research in biology, neuroscience, psychology, economics, et cetera, is demonstrating in, you know, controlled large-scale surveys.
Yeah, and conversely, though, you know, like, if you give someone an academic paper, they are going to either not understand it or fall asleep.
Or both,
because you can only, you're really nailing this one point over and over and over again, and so it's a really fine line to be able to serve. And the guys at University of Chicago, the team up there, is always like, they can't stand Malcolm Gladwell, they like Dan Pink. They sort of feel like there's a trusted narrator, and here's it's in part because Gladwell's such a goddamn good storyteller that he is almost like he can't help himself. What I enjoyed about your book is it draws on so much of literature that I've sort of read a bit, and then connecting different elements of it. And the other thing, I'll keep adding this, things you can do, because one of them was also just read a book. That's good for you.
It's such a good one, and it's such an easy one, right? I mean, people can pick up a book all the time. You can read a book on your phone. You can, you know, pick up a book in an airport. And yet many people say, well, I just don't have time to read. I just don't have time to read. And reading a book is good for us psychologically. It's good for us physically. It's good for us cognitively. So choose a book you love.
I'm curious too, like, when did you decide that this was your field? I mean, was this like as an undergraduate, did you find yourself sort of gravitating to these ideas? Was it in grad school? Was it early in your career? And because I think sometimes, and I certainly know this for, you know, myself, sort of getting in the sort of comedy and satire field, was I had an interest in sharing my voice, but not out in front. I wanted to share it from behind, and that's why I became a producer and did what I did. But I'm curious what led you to this world.
Well, so I majored in psychology and as an undergraduate. I loved it, and I loved thinking about it. I loved reading about it. I loved talking about it, etc. But I really decided, as do many psych majors, there's sort of a, you know, decision point. Do you want to be a therapist? You know, do you want to do that sort of, you know, one-on-one work with clients? Or are you more interested in the research aspect? And for me, I wasn't particularly interested in the therapy aspect, nor did I think I would be particularly good at it. And so the research aspect was really what was interesting to me. Mm-hmm. And the thing that I've liked most about the research that I've done and continue to do is that I really want to do research that matters. So I like the research. I like the idea of solving a puzzle and getting an answer and testing it. But I really want, at the end of the day, to be doing research on things that make a difference in the world, and that are not just, you know, oh, isn't this an interesting, you know, trick or phenomenon or whatever. And so I've been drawn to research questions about things related to things that matter: health, happiness, relationships, and so on.
Yeah. Okay. That's great. So the way we end our podcast always is we ask our guests for a yes and story. So in the parlance of improvisation, you can't say no. You have to, and you can't just stop at yes, right? You have to say yes and. Mm-hmm. You have to affirm and contribute in order to explore and heighten. That's a rule of improvisation. It's a good rule for life. And I'm wondering if you've got a yes and story for us.
I do. So about 5 years ago now, some students approached me and said, we need a faculty advisor for the cancer support group at Amherst College. And would you be the advisor? And I was like, oh, God, no. You know, that's really, it sounds kind of depressing. My mother had died of ovarian cancer, so it was, you know, hitting a little bit close to home. I just felt, you know, I'm busy. I've got three kids. I've got this. And, you know, and really, I spent about 6 months trying to find a different person to be the faculty advisor for this group. And ultimately, I realized I really should say yes. I really should say yes. And I'm going to say yes. And so I said yes, and it was about 5 years ago now. And this group meets in my house about once a month. And it's students who, in some cases, have a parent who has died of cancer. In some cases, it's students who have a parent who is in cancer treatment. In some cases, it's students who themselves are in remission from their own experience with cancer. And I will say it is just a group of the nicest, most thoughtful, sweetest, gentle students. And every time that they're here, they leave and I'm just sort of struck with, this is something that feels meaningful to me. This is something that matters. And being involved with this group of students, and of course the students change as they, you know, graduate and new students come in and so on. But it's been something that I really, really wanted to say no to. I ended up saying yes to, and it couldn't be more meaningful to me.
All right. Can I yes and your yes and?
Yes, yes.
So the listeners to this podcast know this because this came up earlier and I've talked about it on the pod. And I was thinking about this reading your book, but my 16-year-old daughter was diagnosed with cancer at the end of August. And I was thinking about this as I was reading your book because it's so relatable to our world. And she's undergoing treatment and she's home right now. We had chemo last week and you know, her mom and her dad have worked their lives in a comedy theater. She grew up taking those classes and we laugh a lot and we cry a lot too. I mean, it's like we're living in that world, but so much of what you were writing about is so relevant to our experience in the hospital. We didn't even cover half the stuff, like the idea of when we have a room with a view, she tends to do better. We do a lot of sharing of personal details between our nurses and ourselves, and so they really see her and they know Nora, and they you know, and we started this sort of hashtag Team Nora, where people, you know, celebrities and, you know, friends of ours who worked at Second City take pictures of themselves with these hashtag Team Nora, and it kind of becomes this, I mean, it's on Facebook, right? So it's this wonderful use of Facebook for this messaging and this inclusion and that we're all part of this community. The fact that you've been sort of working adjacent, you know, with this is so interesting because it really does. It's, you know, you don't ask. We have a phrase in improvisation, which is play the scene you're in, not the scene you want to be in. And so that's what we're doing. We're playing the scene we're in. And, you know, once you start playing, you realize, oh, there's a lot of joy here to be had. And I've read Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning, you know, and there's other people who've gone through horrific things and still are able to find, you know, joy. So that's amazing that ends up being your yes and story when it was dominating my thought while I was reading this book.
That's really eerie, and I'm so glad that you shared that with me, and I will be thinking about your family and your daughter.
Thank you. All right, the book is called The Positive Shift: Mastering Mindset to Improve Happiness, Health, and Longevity. Catherine Sanderson, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you so much. Well, I've been working in a coal mine.